Peter B. Collins with news and comment. It's Tuesday, September 25th, 2012. In our in-depth interview released to our subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, we spend more than an hour with investigative reporter Greg Pallast. His new book is called Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, subtitled How to Steal an Election in 9 Easy Steps. Has a lot of great satirical cartoons from Ted Rall and an introduction from Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And in this excerpt from our conversation with Greg Pallast, we talk about the way that Republicans have a coordinated effort to suppress voter participation by Democrats. And Greg Pallast starts with Wisconsin and this summer's attempt to recall Governor Scott Walker, and how it is the model for the 50-state voter suppression effort headed for, intended for this November's presidential election, and of course the election of the Senate and the House. Here's an important excerpt from that conversation with Greg Pallast.
I have to tell you, Peter, did anyone ever think of Wisconsin as a swing state? Not until June of this year, when Governor Walker, who had more people sign to remove him from office in a recall, than had even voted against him before. I mean, it was impossible for him to retain office. So what happened, and how did Wisconsin suddenly become a swing state? It's only a swing state not from the polls, but from the count of the vote.
Right.
Or the way that they counted it. And the Democrats have all kinds of reasons why Wisconsin was unusual. Let me tell you, Wisconsin was a dry, I won't call it a dry run, it was a wet, drown the cats run for November. We have 50 Wisconsins on our plate. People do not understand what is going on here. The election is being stolen. And it doesn't matter, by the way, people are asleep. If you look at the beginning of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, it has, you know, from the Elections Assistance Commission, these are official numbers, 5.9 million votes were cast and not counted, and legal voters stopped from voting. That's official U.S. government stats. Now, 6 million votes went down the tubes. Yeah, Obama won. That doesn't mean that those votes weren't stolen. First of all, I think he's going to need those 6 million this time, and it will be 10 million. But the other is, it's not about Obama. First of all, there's other races. According to the University of Minnesota in Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, I do mention that the University of Minnesota, not Greg Pallast, says that 7 U.S. senators, Republicans, are there not because they were voted into office, but that they were that they had enough votes not counted to get into office.
So,
the list purged to get into office. Now, that's 7 senators. If they take control of the Senate, they have the House, they have the Supreme Court, you can put a moat around the White House and just pull up the gates because it won't matter anymore who's in the Oval Office. So there's a lot of elections, and there's one final thing, too. If we want a president of any party who's going to listen to the voters' votes have to count. I keep emphasizing this. I had a discussion with Paul Krugman, who kept saying, we need a leader like FDR. I said, if we have the voters, the FDR will find us.
You can hear the full interview with Greg Pallast. It's available today for subscribers at peterbcollins.com. Glenn Greenwald, in my view, is a great commentator of today's American scene, trained as a constitutional lawyer, and he was writing for Salon.com for quite a while, and I didn't quite realize that they have parted ways. But Glenn is now a columnist for the Guardian newspaper in England, and I recommend that you bookmark their website, guardian.co.uk, and keep up with Greg. He's publishing almost every day now. And I want to point out two recent posts. Today's column is about America's drone program, the use of unmanned aerial vehicles to wage war in areas that are beyond America's approved war zones, like in Pakistan, in Yemen, in Somalia, and elsewhere. And Greenwald reports on a new study completed by researchers at the NYU School of Law and Stanford University Law School called Living Under Drones, Death, Injury, and Trauma to Civilians from U.S. Drone Practices in Pakistan. The report is based on over 130 detailed interviews with victims and witnesses of drone activity. Their family members, former Pakistani government officials, representatives from five political parties in Pakistan, and many others. And the witnesses have provided first-hand accounts of drone strikes, testimony about a range of issues. And here is a quick read from the summary of this report. It says, in the United States, the dominant narrative about the use of drones in Pakistan is of a surgically precise and effective tool that makes the U.S. safer by enabling targeted killing of terrorists with minimal downsides or collateral impacts. And it flatly states, this narrative is false. Following 9 months of intensive research, this report presents evidence of the damaging and counterproductive effects of current U.S. drone strike policies. And I think this is important to link to the outburst of anti-U.S. sentiment that is largely in the American media linked to the release of the anti-Islamic video on YouTube. But I believe that that is merely an excuse or a provocation for the pent-up anger against the United States for our policies and the way that we kill people. And this gets skirted over because in the American media, the drones are a good thing because our troops are not put at risk. And of course, we don't report, as Medea Benjamin did in her important book about drones, on the fact that many of them crash and don't return to their base, that it takes 250 to 300 humans on the ground to run the drones and analyze all the data that they produce. And so a lot of the impressions that we have about drones are really not accurate. And I deplore the lack of any debate in our government, from our Congress, about the expansion of the use of drones under President Obama. And, of course, there's silence from Republicans because they think it's a good thing, and there's silence from Democrats because they don't want to undermine their president. But this is bigger than Obama. This is a new form of warfare, and it should have been authorized by Congress. And other than footing the bill through defense appropriations, Congress has had very little to say. And just last week we reported that the administration is in court claiming that the drone program is secret. And therefore, litigation related to it cannot proceed. Also, we talked yesterday about the Mujahideen Ikhalq, the MEK, which is this Iranian-based dissident group. They had been in Iraq, and we sent them back into Iran. And as we reported, two things developed on Friday. One, the State Department took them off of the international terrorism list, and a group of Americans from both political parties have been furiously lobbying and getting large amounts of cash to give speeches to MEK. And as I pointed out, if peace activists had done this, they'd be arrested by the FBI, and they might be held under the president's new detention powers under the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act. We also reported that Brian Williams on an NBC News program on Friday night reported that the MEK has been working for the U.S. and Israel to kill the Iranian scientists, the nuclear scientists, who have been brutally murdered in broad daylight, often by motorcycle assassins who ride along their car, attach a magnetic bomb, and then detonate it as they ride off into presumably safety. And so I want to point out to you that Greenwald has a recent article, just published a few days ago, that raises important issues about the MEK and about America's unholy alliance with that group that just last week was called a terrorist group, and now they're not. They're ours in some way, shape, or form. It's the General Assembly week at the United Nations, so a lot of news is generated from New York and the UN. President Obama challenged the Arab world in a 30-minute speech today to use its newfound embrace of democracy to ensure protection for freedom of religion and speech. And he framed his speech around Chris Stevens, the ambassador to Libya, who was killed in Benghazi on September 11th of this year. And I give the president credit for walking a fine line. As you know, I fundamentally disagree with the notion that we must take all steps to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. And we reported yesterday, Gareth Reporter's investigation, that the Iranian weapons negotiator offered to stop uranium enrichment at the 20% level, well below weapons grade, in exchange for the lifting of the sanctions. And that not only hasn't been reported in the United States, but it appears to have been ignored. And I think it's important to note that the Iranians don't just, sit there and try to buy time and run out the clock. They have made substantive proposals. We just don't hear about them in the corporate media. So the president resisted the push from Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli government, and its American supporters to draw what they call a red line, set a date after which we would attack Iran and destroy its nuclear facilities. And I give the president credit for not taking that bait. Now, what he did say, the United States will do what we must to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, and warning that time to diplomatically resolve the Iranian nuclear issue is not unlimited. But he refused to go further than what he has said in the past, that a nuclear-armed Iran is not a challenge that can be contained, despite the pleas from Netanyahu. As I mentioned yesterday, he's busy campaigning for Mitt Romney as he visits the United States. Now, the president also went on to say that we support the Arab Spring. He didn't mention the asterisks of Bahrain and the aspirations of people in Saudi Arabia and the Arab Emirates for the kind of freedom that we claim to promote. And so I have to say that the president's speech didn't speak to me very much, but he did, I think, restate a lot of American fundamentals. And, as I said, I'm pleased that he did not move more in the direction that Netanyahu wants. Meanwhile, I always have trouble with this guy's name, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, making his last appearance as president. His term is running out, so he will not be back at the United Nations next fall. And, of course, in the past, he has drawn headlines by supporting the 9/11 truth movement. We don't need your help, Mahmoud. And also by claiming that the Holocaust didn't happen and those sorts of things that really irritate Israel. Well, apparently Ban Ki-moon, the head of the UN, the general, whatever his title is, he had words with Ahmadinejad and said, play it down a little bit here. Let's not provoke any more tensions. And it's Secretary General, the leader of the United Nations. I got that straight now. Anyway, so in a kind of clever move, Ahmadinejad just said, well, look, Iran has been here for thousands of years. He said 6,000 or 7,000. And he said the Zionists have only occupied their part of the region for 60 to 70 years. They have no roots there in history, he said. They do not even enter the equation for Iran. Now, that's a way to provoke Israelis, and I'm sure that is his intention, but it's a different flavor of what he has said in the past. A European court on Monday ruled that radical Muslim cleric Abu Hamza al-Masri can be extradited to the United States to face terrorism charges, that he was trying to set up an al-Qaeda training camp in rural Oregon back in 2001-2002. He was arrested in Britain in 2004 at the request of the United States. They accuse him of assisting the taking of hostages in Yemen in 1998 and the Oregon training camp that we described a moment ago. And he has been cleared after arguing that he would be subjected to torture or inhuman and degrading treatment or punishment if sent to the United States. Typically, they resist this kind of extradition because we have the death penalty on the federal books, and many European countries refuse to extradite to a potential execution. At least from this article that I'm looking at from the Associated Press, that claim was not presented in this dispute. We're learning that in the United States military, about 20% of our personnel reported heavy drinking in the most recent year that data were collected, which is 2008. And reports of binge drinking increased to 47%, up from 35% 10 years before. And they also noted that rates of illicit and prescription drug abuse are relatively low, but the misuse of opioid painkillers like OxyContin has risen sharply by 11%. To 11%, up from 2% just 10 years ago. And, of course, the question that I have that they don't answer here is how many of our soldiers serving in Afghanistan are partaking of the local hashish and opium? I have been waiting for a scandal to surface, and I have often played a spoof song from the British group The Stranglers from back in the 1980s that ridiculed the Soviet troops who went to Afghanistan and got hooked on the local opiates. In my San Francisco Chronicle this morning, the token conservative, Deborah J. Saunders, correctly whacks President Obama for the comments he made in the Univision interview in Miami the other day. And he got a pretty tough question from Jorge Ramos regarding a promise that Obama had made to Ramos back in 2008. I guarantee that in the first year, an immigration bill that I strongly support and that I'm promoting will have it. And I want to move forward as quickly as possible. Well, Saunders correctly dings the president because he didn't attempt at any step that I can remember to promote a measure other than the DREAM Act related to immigration law in this country. He ducked the issue just like he did climate change and others. And on the one hand, you can understand it because of the incredible garbage that was on his desk left over from the Bush administration when he arrived. But at the same time, if we're going to be honest, the president did not expend political capital in that direction. And so it's fair to hold him accountable as he seeks re-election. Naomi Wolf has written a new book called Vagina, A New Biography. I haven't read it. I don't think it's particularly written for me. But she's gotten a lot of publicity recently, and the New York Times ran a book review on September 16th, and the one about Naomi Wolf's book was written in a snarky way by Tony Bentley, who is a retired dancer with the New York City Ballet. And she's an accomplished author of five books, including a memoir. And I don't know Tony Bentley, and I don't really have any beef with her. But I do want to come to Naomi Wolf's defense, because in the middle of this this critical review of her new book, Vagina, Tony Bentley takes a swipe at Naomi Wolf for the work that she's done kind of outside her own defined domain. And the critic writes here, Wolf's book is undermined by the fact that she has rendered herself less than unreliable over the past couple of decades, with one rant more hysterical than another. Fascist America, great sex behind the burqa, the Stalinist plot against Occupy Wall Street, and a particularly loathsome, self-victimizing, and vindictive piece about the Shakespeare scholar Harold Bloom. Now, I haven't read Wolf's piece about Harold Bloom, but the alarms that she has sounded about creeping fascism in the United States and the plot against Occupy Wall Street are items that I truly respect her for. She could stay in a very safe zone writing about female and feminist issues, and she doesn't. And if you listen to the interview she gave to Sibel Edmonds and me in the Boiling Frog series, I believe it was about 9 months, maybe a little longer ago, she's bright, she is committed, she knows the Constitution, and she knows when it's being violated. And so I just want to add my own two cents here and speak up for Naomi Wolf on those issues. And whether you want to read her biography of the vagina or not is entirely up to you. And finally today, he is back. The Terminator, the Governator, the guy who ruined the economy here in California after winning the recall election and replacing Gray Davis. And he now has bought himself a chair at the University of Southern California. They're calling him Professor Schwarzenegger. That's an insult to real professors. And he has funded a think tank to the tune of about $20 million, some from his movie fortune and I guess some from some rich friends. And, you know, maybe what will come out of this might be interesting, but I doubt it. I think it's just an effort to rehabilitate himself and also to promote a new autobiography, which is due out next week. And in it, he recounts the episode the day after he left Sacramento and stepped down as governor. His then-wife, Maria Shriver, got him to attend a couples counseling meeting. And he writes, "The minute we sat down, the therapist turned to me and said, 'Maria wanted to come here and ask about a child, whether you fathered a child with your housekeeper, Mildred Baena.'" That's what Schwarzenegger reports. And he says, "It's true." Then he told Shriver she was a perfect wife who still turned him on. And he says the backstory is that he and the housekeeper had sex while the wife and kids were away on vacation, and he was stuck in town working on a movie. Now, the history of his groping and his dalliances and his affairs and the way he snuck women in through the secret entrance in his office in Brentwood, there are too many of those stories to just dismiss them, as the media did when he was running for governor in the recall. Arnold, I ain't buying what you're selling. And I won't go to any of your stupid movies either. Thanks for listening to my ravings. I'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until